Welcome to Talaterra, a podcast about freelance educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. Who are these educators? What do they do? Join me and let's find out together. This is your host, Tanya Marion. Today, my guest is Susan Chung. Susan is an experienced co-design artist and a science educator. Her specialty areas are environmental education and intergenerational mentorship. Her work promoting architecture as ecological education that helps youth respond creatively to ecological challenges has been recognized by the Royal Architectural Institute of Canada. Susan teaches youth about sustainable design and has organized fairs and forums and conferences for youth, parents, and the public. I met Susan in 2015 at a conference. She was setting up her booth in the exhibitors hall. I was intrigued by the information she had put out up to that point, and I stayed there for a while to study it. I struck up a conversation with her and the other person who was there. I stayed there long enough for the conversation to turn towards the type of space I would like to create. Susan needed to start a demo piece for visitors to her booth, so since I was the first person there, the space that I had been thinking about was going to be the focus of this demonstration piece. I sat down with Susan and she began asking me questions. Susan didn't ask me to describe the space as I saw it. Instead, she asked me what I would do in the space. I shared with her the thoughts and ideas I have for an interpretive studio, and this is where things became magical. As I spoke, my words became images. It was a mind-blowing experience to see my words and actions land on paper in the form of drawings. What Susan did in that moment was lead me through the co-design process. She does a beautiful job of describing the co-design experience in this episode. How was Susan introduced to co-design? What happens during a co-design session? How does Susan involve youth in the design of sustainable communities? Let's find out. When did you begin your work in co-design, and how were you introduced to it?
I was introduced to co-design through the inventor of co-design. He's a man named Stanley King, and he believed that children and the community had a stake in what a new space to be designed needs to be. So in other words, he didn't think it was up to architects and planners to be designing a new space without input from people, and particularly input from children. And I first began this work when he did a big co-design for the city of Vancouver called City Plan. And City Plan was a huge co-design where imagine groups of people who are in neighborhoods speaking to an artist, and the artist has a blank sheet of paper. So maybe the blank sheet of paper might look like this. And somebody would say, if my neighborhood was designed to my satisfaction, then I would be bicycling. And another person might say, well, I would be having a conversation with my friend. And another person might say, well, I would be sitting at an outdoor cafe. And as they talk, the artist was trained to draw exactly what they were saying at the moment that they were speaking. And so we might get an illustration that looks something like this. So there's the person in a bicycle and another person talking to friends and another person with an outdoor cafe. And Stanley trained us to draw these very quick sketches to the direction of people. He trained us to be the artist for the mind's eye. And if I had three different people talking, then these three people would begin the drawing. And pretty soon, more people would enter the drawing. And eventually, this drawing became design criteria for the planners and architects. So I was intrigued by this process. He had to recruit about 50 artists. So he put out a call for an audition of artists. And we were required to draw a man, a woman, and a child on a street with trees, with buildings beside it. And we were required to draw that scene in under 5 minutes. That was the audition. And then he trained us to be listeners, to listen to people's story. And here we have maybe three or four people's story, and they're weaved into one drawing. And I've been doing it ever since. So I started doing this in 1992 for City Plan.
When did you start working with children? You have, let me share one of the your activities with listeners that I really like. In one of your activities, you ask people where they see themselves. Well, actually, you ask youth where they see themselves on the urban wilderness continuum.
Yes.
You ask them if they live in the wilderness, in the city, in the suburbs, or in a village. And you also ask them to imagine their ideal world and to identify where they would live along this urban wilderness continuum. What have you learned about youth preferences when they imagine their ideal world? Where do they live? How much green space is in their ideal world?
For young people, when we do this activity, and it's called, I called it wilderness person and urban person. So I asked them who likes to go camping, and that person would be wilderness person, and who likes to who loves to be in the city, and I asked them to find their sweet spot between the urban and the wilderness, because every urban space began as a wilderness. Every place began as an ecosystem untouched by urbanization. And over time, typically 100 years, a city develops. And the city is the world's fastest growing human settlement. And somehow, we need to encourage young people to find their sweet spot between the wilderness in the city so that they can reimagine a new place. And really, with the climate crisis, our lives depend on this. Our lives depend on children and youth naming what their future is like. What is their sweet spot? And so co-design is part of this. I invite them to find themselves along this wilderness and urban divide. They normally place themselves somewhere closer to the nature, closer to the wilderness. Sometimes they place themselves right in the middle. There are a few children who want to be nearer to the urban, but they always say that they would like some of the urban amenities, such as access to healthcare and education, access to opportunities, but they never, ever want to lose touch with nature from where the urban place came. And of course, the place in nature where the urban landscape sprung up is also indigenous land. So it's a recognition of unceded territory. And I myself are on the unceded territory of the Musqueam people and the Tsleil-Waututh people and the Squamish people. That is the land that I am on right now. So part of our co-design work is to put people in touch with the land and in touch with the indigenous culture that has occupied this land.
And when you do the same activity with adults, do their responses differ? Do they place themselves differently on the continuum?
It depends on the question you ask them. If you ask them, where would you like to live? Then they might talk about solutions such as high rises and townhouses and things. But if you ask the co-design questions, which is the question that we ask during our work, then they often answer differently. We ask them to cast their minds forward and imagine that this place is done and designed to your satisfaction. So this is the question that we ask.
Cast your minds forward and imagine this place is done and designed to your satisfaction. What would you be doing here? That's where we begin.
When people begin to talk about their lives, then they don't talk about solutions anymore. They don't talk about solutions such as roads and cars and where they're going to put the buildings. Instead, they talk about life, which usually means walking or biking to move around. Because in your ideal world, nobody says in their ideal world that they're going to get up in the morning and get into their car and get into a traffic jam into a building and start staring at a screen for 8 hours. What we typically hear people say is, in my ideal world, I'm walking and there's green space around me and there's beautiful smells and there's beautiful sights. And this is typically in nature. So with the adults, I find that when you ask them the co-design questions, what would you be doing and what is around you, then I do find that they have the same response as the youth. So they answer the question as an organism within an ecosystem. They talk about their senses. They talk about what they wish to do. And they don't talk necessarily like an adult. So in some ways, co-design encourages people to be like youth and children. They encourage people to think with their bodies and their senses. And when you ask anybody that question, no matter how old they are, then they will tend to talk about nature. And most of our co-design drawings happen on the outside. They happen in an outdoor space. Later, I can show you a link to some co-design drawings. I mean, even your co-design drawing, was that outside or was that with a view to outside?
That was, we did it in the exhibit hall. There weren't any windows nearby, not that I remember, in that space.
I meant the drawing.
Oh, the drawing? Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Outside. Outside. It's about outside space and looking outside from the indoors.
So what I find very interesting is I probably didn't prompt you and tell you, let's put ourselves outside. You put yourself outside. So when a planner or an architect is designing a new space and they ask children or they ask adults where they wish to be and what they wish to do and what are they seeing and hearing and smelling around them, then our participants start speaking as organisms in an ecosystem. I really feel that this process brings out the organism in us. I don't know if I have any proof of this. The only proof I have is whenever I make a co-design drawing, people always place themselves outside. It never fails. And it's not because we have some, it's not because the artist is trying to force people to go outside. We always ask the same question. All right, imagine that this place is now designed to your satisfaction. What are you doing? What's going on around you? What are you hearing? What are you smelling? And then they'll place these things in the drawing. It's almost like I'm a storyboard artist for a movie, except it's your movie. And it's the movie of everyone around you. And the work that we do with youth, we do the co-design process with young people. When they're young enough, like in elementary school, they make their own drawing. So they draw themselves doing something in their environment. And then they put together how they interact with each other. For older students, we train the students to be the co-design facilitator, to act as the facilitator artist. And then for adults, we act as their artists, because typically adults have gained a lot of self-consciousness about drawing. They don't want to be drawing things and showing people their drawing. And so we give them the safety of having an artist draw their ideas for them as they speak.
Regarding your comment about data, having information to back up what you've observed, you have so much information. you've done this so many times and had so many conversations. There's a book there for sure, don't you think?
Yes, there is a book. And in fact, there has been a book published on co-design. It is called Co-Design, A Method of Design Participation. It is written written by Stanley King, Marinda Conley, and Drew Ferrari. Oh, there it is. Where did you get that book?
On the used book market. I found it. I was so inspired. I had to have this book.
That's a brilliant book. Well, that is a manual of co-design, although it doesn't tell you our youth program. Our youth program is actually very different. And we've even modified the youth program to include First Nations content, because when the youth program began, that was missing. So I can talk a little bit about the youth program. Oh, the youth manual, yes. We're actually going to be editing that youth manual, because the beginning part, I suppose you've read it or read the beginning part of it.
I've read the beginning, yes. And
with the sitting on the wall activity?
Yes, I love that activity.
It's a beautiful activity.
Yes. And so, okay, since we are here for on that, because that is one of my questions. You and the co-design group lead youth through this really engaging activity, as you've mentioned it, the city on the wall, that's what it's called. Explain this activity for listeners.
Yes. Okay. So imagine a blank sheet of paper and some children in front of the blank sheet of paper. And these children are to design a new space. Suppose some planners and architects want to know what young people would like to do there. So the first part of the activity we call the city on the wall. And the purpose of this activity is to show what urbanization does. So we say, imagine you were here when the land was new. What would you see here? What would you smell? What would you hear? And they typically would say, we would see trees. We would hear birds. We would see a bear. We would see a salmon, an eagle. And then so we would quickly draw these things. And then we say, you like it here. And so you build a cabin. So sometimes this happens, right? The current way that we do the city on the wall, we say, imagine that you're observing things. And who would you see here besides the animals and the plants? Would there be people here? And the kids would describe First Nations people, a First Nations settlement with a longhouse, with a fire, fishing and hunting and ceremony. And then we say, in the distance, you see some people coming in a canoe. And they like it here, so they begin to build a cabin. And the cabin, one of the cabins becomes a store. And suddenly, it can become any city that we know. Because every human settlement started like this. And we ask, if you could put anything you want in the city, what would you put here? And then we start giving pens to the kids, because we say, this is how every city began. Every city began in the wilderness, began in an ecosystem where there were already people living there, indigenous people, and somebody came along and decided to build cabins and a store. And now it can become any city you know. What would you put here? So then the children think about it a bit, and they say, we would want to put McDonald's there, and we want to put a shopping mall, and we want to put a jail, and we want to put an amusement park, and we want to put places to live. So we want to put some high rises. And as you give them more pens, they come up and they start building their city. And then they all sit down and you ask them, do you want to live here? And most of the time they say, no, no, we don't want to live here. And we asked them why. And they said, well, what happened to the birds? What happened to the forest? What happened to the bear? What happened to the stream that the salmon was swimming in? And we say, that's right. The stream is gone. The bear is gone. The trees are gone. And then we say, these are all solutions, but we don't even know what the question is yet. But there's a reason why we build so many cities. The city's the fastest growing human settlement because it's a very successful settlement. People get better education in the city. There's more opportunities. There's lots of reasons for wanting to be in the city. But if everybody built cities like this, we would need four Earths. And so we begin again. And we ask a different question. We ask the co-design questions. So then we begin all over again. We take down the city because now that everybody has had the fun of building whatever they want, they discover that urban sprawl results, and they really don't want that. So instead of building solutions, we start asking questions about life. and we ask some fundamental ecological questions. We begin with a new sheet of paper, and we ask three fundamental ecological questions. Number one, if this place was designed to your satisfaction, what would you do in a 24-hour day? And number two, if this place is designed to your satisfaction, what would you yourself be doing if you were to speak for yourself? And then the third question would be, how would you interact with others? And I would like to point out that these three questions are ecological questions. You can ask them of any creature on Earth. You can ask an owl, what would you do during your 24-hour day? And what would you personally be doing, and how would you interact with others? You could ask a squirrel that. You could ask a person that. And we also ask them to use all of their senses. If this place was designed to your satisfaction, what would you hear and smell and see? And how would you move around? What would your path be? And when we ask this question, you get a different response. You don't get all these buildings. You don't get all the cars. You don't get the roads. You, in fact, get a sustainable place, and it's sustainability without being oppressive. So nobody's telling these kids, take shorter showers, drive less. It's a positive response because people are being creative and they're stating their desires. So it turns out that our deepest fundamental desires for our environment is ecological. Maybe it gets back to where we used to live a million years ago. Maybe we're tapping into that. I don't know. But all I know is when we do the co-design work, people put themselves outside and people move around by walking and cycling and skateboarding. And people are smelling and hearing and feeling nature. Somehow that is the response that we get. And this is an ecological response, and it is a response, I believe, that's a positive way to address climate change.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And how many stories are shared with you? Nature stories from childhood or recent nature stories that there are participants in this type of a workshop, in or any type of the activities, how many of them share nature stories with you?
I would say almost all of them. So as an example, there was a project that we recently did for the Canada Lands Company. Canada Lands Company is a crown corporation. They are the real estate developer for the government of Canada, and they own land everywhere in this country. So one of the pieces of land that they owned was called Heather Lands. And it's a piece of land right in the middle of the city of Vancouver, where we actually have a housing crisis and incredibly inflated real estate, right? Anyway, this land is also the unceded territory of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and the Musqueam people. And so we did a co-design with the First Nations people and with First Nations youth. So as an example, one of the images that they made, and I wish I could have it in front of me, but Canada Lands has this image. My participants were teenagers from the Squamish Nation, and they drew themselves playing basketball because they were basketball players, and they were in a gym. But the gym had floor-to-ceiling windows that could somehow withstand like a basketball hit, right? That's a design solution for the architect. And these floor-to-ceiling windows had a beautiful Douglas fir forest in the background. So that was an example where these teenagers wanted a somewhat urban environment, such as a basketball court, but they specified a Douglas fir forest with Douglas fir trees because they were still in touch with their land and in touch with nature. So that's an example. Another example is an elementary school which did a co-design for their community garden. The parents and the teachers could only talk about sheds and beds and where to put them. So these were solutions like the city on the wall. The kids, when asked the co-design questions, talked about rolling down a hill and eating blueberries. And therefore, the landscape architect had to put a hill.
and blueberry plants. And these are just a few examples.
Yeah, I've read that Stanley King's co-design process predates, and the collaborative drawing process predates UNICEF's Child-Friendly Cities initiative by 25 years.
Yes.
And for listeners' benefit, the Child-Friendly Cities is a UNICEF initiative, and reading from your youth manual, children's rights are, there are seven listed here. One, influence decisions about their city. Two, express their opinion on the city they want. Three, participate in family, community, and social life. Four, walk safely in the streets on their own. Five, meet friends and play. Six, have green spaces for plants and animals. And seven, live in an unpolluted environment. It goes on to say in the book that the city on the wall exercise addresses the first three about influencing what happens in their city and the kind of city they want and what they would do in the city. It's a very powerful exercise. How many times do you think over the years have you led this city on the wall?
I've led the city on the wall since 2010 in my classroom. But Stanley has led the city on the wall since the 1970s. And as an example, the city on the wall, of course, is just the intro activity. And it's really the activity afterwards that is very beautiful, where we do the site walk and we ask the children, if this place was designed to your satisfaction, what would you hear and see and smell? And what would you do here? The fundamental question is, what would you do? And I've done it many, many times. I've observed the results of it, this program being done enough times to see it transform the place of my city. So as an example, getting back to what Stanley did in the early 70s, he did the city on the wall on a space that was supposed to be a high rise in the middle of Vancouver. Are we able to share a screen here?
At this point in our conversation, Susan started to share her screen and showed me images of the Robson Square project and some archival video as well. I kept this section in because it's very interesting and very relevant to how the co-design process is applied to real-life settings. You're able to learn more about the Robson Square project on the co-design website. Check the show notes for links.
So in the early 70s, there was a huge parking lot in the middle of Vancouver, which was supposed to be designed. And Stanley somehow convinced people that children should be included in the design. I actually don't know how he did this. Okay. So this was the space. And then at this space, he did the city on the wall activity. So this was the space right here. And these are teenagers from the early 70s talking about what they would like to smell and see and hear in this big parking lot. And when the kids were asked to make the drawings, this is what they drew. So in the middle of a city in the early 70s, they drew a forest with a stream. Okay. And then they also drew this, which was a fountain with all these kids playing around it. So the children spoke. And you can imagine the architects could have said, that's crazy. We're not going to do that. But no, they actually promised that they would listen to the children. And they also said this. And this is very powerful. I mean, who in the 1970s was saying no cars? They also drew an outdoor cafe. And in Vancouver, at the time, there was no outdoor cafe. And they also drew a dome. What Arthur Erickson designed eventually was Robson Square. So Robson Square is a 3-block roof garden because the children wanted green space. So they hired Cornelia Hahn Oberlander, who has the Order of Canada for her landscape work, to design the first 3-block roof garden in North America.
And they also made skating with the domes that the children talked about. So remember that this was the early 70s. In the early 70s, somebody made a green roof spanning three blocks. And Arthur Erickson made a beautiful design. And really, these were children. These were children's ideas. And people listened to the ideas. And the co-design program has been used to design places ever since to include people. And recently, since 2009, my job as an environmental educator has been to reinterpret the program, but not change it much, so that it's addressing our current crisis of climate change in a positive manner. So where I come in is to identify the parts of this process which are ecological and to frame it with that ecological lens. And of course, I'm also a co-design artist. We recently did a project, another project with the Canada Lands Company for the Jericho Lands, which is several acres of land also partly owned by First Nations. And we just finished that project. It was an amazing project. Because of Robson Square, sometimes I wonder at these co-design workshops, in these youth workshops, what prescient ideas I'll be drawing, or the young people will be drawing, that would become the big ideas of the future. And so I feel great privilege to do this work, because I feel like I'm seeing into the future, and it's a positive future, even though we're talking about climate change here.
What's next for you?
That's a very good question. I believe that I would like to continue to do co-design because it's a passion. And we hope to include First Nations artists because there's reconciliation going on in Canada right now, and land being given back to First Nations people. And when we talk about nature, and co-design seems to always lead back to nature, this nature is traditional territory. And I strongly feel that we need to include more First Nations youth to co-design their future communities. So it is my goal to somehow include the input of First Nations artists in the process, so that they may guide us on how co-design should proceed into the future. That's one of my goals.
Well, that's wonderful, Susan. And you can do this. You are revising the youth manual, you said.
Absolutely, because the city on the wall is fundamentally a colonial activity. When you read it, it's like, here's you in your canoe, you come across this beautiful piece of nature, and you just decide to build a cabin here, right? So most recently, when we did the Jericho Lands Project, we actually decided that the Jericho Lands Project children's co-design had to include at least somebody from the First Nations. And so we asked a young Squamish woman named Ariana Bruce to do some drumming and to be part of the City on the Wall story. So we did the City on the Wall almost exactly as it's written in the youth manual, except we told it in the third person. We didn't say, here's you and your canoe coming. We said, imagine you were here 200 years ago and this place was an ecosystem. What would you see here? What would you smell? And so on. Who is living here? And then they would start to describe who is living here. And then Ariana Bruce, the young Squamish woman, began drumming, a heartbeat sound on her drum. And she began singing. And as she sung and as she was drumming, we could all imagine being here 200 years ago. And she spoke and said, what do you think my people would be doing here? And they said, fishing for salmon. They said, peeling cedar bark off of the cedar trees, picking berries. And she led and facilitated part of that story. And when she was done, I said, you look into the distance and you notice some boats with people coming. And they see this land
and they like it, and they decide to build a cabin here. And suddenly, the building of that cabin, it seems so aggressive. Whereas in the beginning, in The City on the Wall, the way it's written now, we need to edit it, by the way, we need to re-edit it for this. I don't think we quite realized how aggressive it was to come to a place and just build without permission. But with Arianna Bruce, the young Squamish woman, being part of that story, everybody realized how transgressive it was to simply start building. And then, of course, we discussed how every city in the world actually started like this, as somebody's land, as somebody's ecosystem, and yet urbanization happened. And then we asked, now, if you could build the perfect city, what would you put here? So we still proceeded to urbanize, because the whole point of The City on the Wall was how not to do things. So we still proceeded with that part. And then we paused there and we said, you know, this is how every city began, and this is the past. And somehow the past needs to be reconciled with the present. So we then talked about the advantages of the city and how most cities develop as the fastest human settlement because of the advantages, because of the opportunities, the economic opportunities, the healthcare, the better education for women, better health outcomes. And we said, look, now it becomes any city you know. If it can become any city you know, what would you put here? So we still asked that question because we wanted them to see that when urbanization happens, it's we who do it and not they. That's actually one of the most important lessons. When they finish building the city, we want them to come to the conclusion that it was the wrong thing to do. But they come to that conclusion themselves. But now they got that out of their system, what not to do, what's been done all along. Now we must ask a different question. And our survival depends on it. I mean, Greta Thunberg and her words, and her words speaking for her generation, really emphasizes the idea that it's necessary for us to find our sweet spot and ask different questions. We can't simply come up with the same solutions. So we propose as co-designers that the solution lies in reimagining life and reimagining what will we do here, and asking in our hearts, deep inside us, what would you like to do? What would you like to see and hear and smell? Because very likely it would be similar to what was there when the place began as a wilderness. I mean, certainly the co-design drawings that we see from young people and from adults. Here is a townhouse complex, of course, from the outside that has a small house and a playground and a basketball court. These were co-designed by real people about a month ago. They're co-designing something that is not necessarily urban sprawl. They're co-designing the outside. And this is how we get back to the way things are supposed to be. So I think as co-designers, we have to trust people to know what they want, and that what they want is going to be the best for them.
To learn more about the co-design process, the City of the Wall activity, and to view videos of past co-design sessions, visit the show notes for this episode. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to the Youth Manual for Sustainable Design. Follow the link and you'll be able to download your own copy. Talaterra is a podcast for and about independent educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and colleagues. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Tanya Marion.